places like Bangladesh, you look at the predictions of what sea level rise will mean for Bangladesh in the next century and how much land will be lost. Clearly, there is the number, I don't know what the numbers are going to be, but all around the world you can see places where people are particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this brings us to a bit of talk about the Arctic. And I guess people, villages in the Arctic are currently being relocated, I guess, by the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit about what's happening up in the Arctic, culturally, as well as with all the Arctic ice melting as well.
Right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we've had the greatest ice extent loss this year of any recorded time because of warming in the region. And sea ice is just such a basic part of Arctic culture and Arctic ecosystems. WWF has historically worked on polar bears in the region and has been working with Ian Sterling on monitoring how climate change is affecting polar bears. And in some ways, the things that are affecting polar bears and sea ice loss are also affecting human communities and cultures. Both polar bears and human communities hunt from the ice. And polar bears were actually seeing decreases in their weight already because the ice season is shorter, so the amount of time that they are not hunting and eating on the ice is reducing. In the case of human communities, their ability to get out on the ice is also limited, although they do have some more technology. They can use boats, although historically they have not used boats for this in many villages. They've gone out onto the ice. And they're losing time on the ice, but they're also losing people. People go out on the ice to try and hunt, and the ice is not as stable as it has been, or they get caught on the floe that moves out. And there's a great deal of concern in indigenous Arctic communities for their access to their culture, essentially disappearing with the Arctic ice.
Mm. I was speaking with some people from Montreal, and there's also a panel discussion where I learned a lot from people who are living up there,
mm-hmm.
and how people are, you know, people have died through falling into ice, which has always been strong enough to walk across, and things like that.
Yep.
And you know, homes sinking into melting permafrost and whatnot. It's quite startling.
Yeah, the picture of the Arctic is very stark. There was a report earlier this year called the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which is, I recommend anyone to go on the web and at least read the short version of the document. It has very dramatic findings in it. What we're seeing in the Arctic is incredible. The speed of change there is unprecedented, and many of the people who'd worked in the region and knew that climate change was happening, once they started down working, sat down and started working on this larger document, were themselves quite surprised when you put it all together at how much was going on.
Mm. Can you talk about some of the findings in specific there?
Well, they talk about the rate of ice extent, and they actually recalculated what that number was. But in relation to that, they also calculated what the loss of terrestrial ice meant, not only for the Arctic, but what that meant for global sea level rise. And it's a much more dramatic rate of sea level rise than was previously predicted. The loss of ice in places like Greenland is also much more dramatic than people were originally believing it to be. In some places, there's essentially almost reservoirs or rivers of water running underneath the ice as it's melting. Hmm. And then the issues of human communities, the issues of changes in species ranges, the movement into the region of pests. Boreal forests are becoming inundated with pests that historically have not been able to live there because of the amount of frost period, which is no longer there. And what that's going to mean economically for forests is quite dramatic as well.
Mm-hmm. I heard in a workshop that Greenland is losing 50 cubic kilometers of ice a year. Do you know if that's true?
The number is something like that.
Yeah. And in some places, there's some ice shelves that have been melting like 5 kilometers in less than a year.
Yeah, the loss of ice is incredible, not only in the Arctic, but also in the Antarctic.
Hmm.
I mean, 2 years ago, we had a piece of the Antarctic ice shelf that wasn't expected to be moving calve off and break apart, leading people to go back in and look at how much the Antarctic is changing, and it's also changing quite dramatically. It's a slightly different system because it's a land mass covered with ice, as opposed to the Arctic, which is dominantly water covered with ice. But there's still dramatic changes happening at both poles.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it would be good here to talk a bit about feedback loops as well, because those are especially prominent in the Arctic, I know. Can you share with us what you know about the few of them that are happening?
Yeah, so, and this was actually highlighted in ASEA as well. One of the other things that happens when we lose this ice in the Arctic is not only does the Arctic become somewhat warmer, but it feeds on itself and continues to become warmer because ice is white. And what happens when solar energy hits ice is that much of it is reflected back up and the energy is reflected back up into the atmosphere. Again, some of it gets trapped because we've increased the thickness of the atmosphere with that CO2. But even more dramatic is that when you replace ice with water, water is very dark, and dark things absorb more heat. And so you end up increasing the heat in the Arctic, melting more ice, opening up more water, allowing for more absorbed heat, melting more ice, opening up more water, which is where we get to where we are now, that we are losing so much ice every year and changing the temperature of the Arctic. The Arctic is... In some scenarios, warming as much as much as or more than maybe 5 times faster than the rest of the planet.
Wow. There's something else I want to talk about too, which is, I think is in the IPCC report, a tipping point, or they phrase it as the point of no return, which was 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that. What you know about that and what that means, and if that is indeed scientifically accurate.
Well, this tipping point idea is sort of tied into this 2-degree idea.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly what concentration in the atmosphere that occurs at is still a little bit of debate because we don't know exactly what the climate sensitivity of the atmosphere is.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept is that at some point, the climate has resilience in it. The climate can respond. And, in fact, everything has resilience in it. Everything can bend to a certain point. It can come back, or it can move on a trajectory that still allows things to remain somewhat like they are. And then at some point, you essentially either, you can think of it as breaking the reed, or you push the marble out of the bowl and it can't get back in. And that point... an array of things happen, and some people are hypothesizing abrupt, dramatic climate change, which would be things like the shutdown of the thermohaline circulation. It could mean dramatic changes in the way carbon is held in peat systems and forests. It could mean a dramatic change in ocean circulation currents, other than the THC, which also have great impacts on the climate. So we get to a point and we dramatically change the climate system in a way that it cannot recover to the condition that we've had the fortune of living in for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of something I'm curious to know if you know much about, which is the report by the Pentagon that came out 2 years ago, which was titled Abrupt Climate Change Scenarios and Implications for National Security. Are you aware of that report at all?
Yeah, I'm aware of that report. I actually haven't read the report myself.
Okay.
But... I mean, if you think about all of the systems that climate change impacts, I mean, it impacts not just temperature, it impacts our availability of water, and by impacting water, you're impacting agriculture, you're impacting human communities, you're impacting transportation. When you think about sea level rise and inundation of large communities, I mean, New York City is expected that with substantial sea level rise, all of the subway system and all of Wall Street will be flooded. We've seen things like what happens to New Orleans. I mean, if we were to have that sort of broad-scale challenge to the global system, that's a huge issue for not only national security, but just human existence. And what does that mean for the communities that we have established?
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to someone about Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and people have been complaining about the way that the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the United States responded to that disaster. And if you look at the history of FEMA, apparently the largest previous storm that they've had to deal with damage from was Hurricane Andrew in South Florida. And in that storm, it was something like 20,000 homes that they had to deal with, finding people new homes and relocating people and making sure that people had money and supplies for food. In New Orleans, that the number of households that they're having to deal with is 400,000. And that's a single, that's New Orleans and the Mississippi coast. So it's a small segment of the coastal population, really. Were you to think about the larger effects of climate change, we're talking about a lot more than 400,000 homes, and we're overwhelmed by that currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite intense. There's a few more things I'd like to talk to you about, and one of which is if you can maybe share with us some abnormalities, because we've talked about these more like region-specific occurrences. But, I mean, just I wonder if you can share with us a few things that are just kind of absurd. I mean, like, I know, like, polar bears and Russian zoos are no longer hibernating in some situations because it's just so warm for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Spain, for example, had the first hurricane ever, I believe. Is that true? Do you know?
I don't know if Spain did. Brazil did.
Brazil, maybe that's what I was thinking of, actually. Okay. And as far as, like, for us living in North America, like, can you talk a bit more about some of the extremes which have been happening, like, weather-wise and just, like, kind of different abnormalities like that?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the easiest ones for that people can actually just sort of measure in their own lives is the shifting time of first frost. These are things that are called, like, they're called phenological changes. They're changes in the timing of things. People can see that frosts are happening. The first frost is generally happening later. Solid freeze of lakes is changing in time. So that's anyone who goes ice skating or snowmobiling or skiing knows that they may think back to their childhood about when they could cross lakes, and that isn't an option anymore until much later in the season. But we also see changes in species. There are anecdotal stories of bird species that now fly up into the Arctic into indigenous populations that don't have words for those species of bird. We see shifts in bird species when they arrive different places. We also see movement in patterns of blooming. They've had to change the planting zones for different parts of North America. Hmm. We see changes in plant species on mountains. We see that they're moving farther north. We also see that vertebrate and invertebrate species are moving farther north. There's a historic survey of Yosemite National Park in California, and apparently the researchers who at the university that had done that historic survey decided to go back decades later and see whether those species were still there. And in fact, they find them, but they find them farther upslope than they had been at the beginning of the century. We also know that species are disappearing. The American pika is disappearing from its range. It's a small mammal. It's related to the rabbit, and it lives in the Great Basin of the United States. And its low-elevation populations are disappearing because it's too hot for it. It has a very limited thermal tolerance.
Hmm.
So we see the signs of climate change all around us.
Mm-hmm.
They happen slowly, generally, though. These aren't things that happen overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But the changes are going on, and if you look back in the records, you can see that they're happening. The reason I wrote the short overview I did about 2005 was that we saw so many large-scale dramatic things happening all at once.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly is a lot. There's certainly a lot going on right now. And maybe to go into a bit of talk about what we can do, one of your areas of expertise is development of conservation strategies. So it says on the website, at least. I wonder if you can talk a bit about conservation strategies as well as mitigation and adaptation,
mm-hmm.
the way you think it's realistically, and what both should be demanded of the government and those in power and people in their own communities can begin to think towards.
Right. Well, so there are actually some of the things overlap between mm-hmm. conservation and between human communities.
Mm-hmm.
But to just sort of give you a brief overview of the work that I'm doing on conservation is we don't have all of the information about how climate change is going to affect every park or every protected area. However, we do have general ideas of what the trends and regions are. And so based on that knowledge and the knowledge that we have to start acting now, because if we wait until we have all the information, it will be too late to step in and do things, either because land use has changed or we've lost too much of whatever it was we needed, or the key factor we identify later on. Sort of to hedge our bets, we've come up with sort of a three-step approach. The first thing we do is we think about how will species need to move in response to climate change, and we protect adequate and appropriate space for that. So there's the work of Jay Malcolm at the University of Toronto, which shows how species of trees will be moving in response to climate change. And we need to think about when we design a protected area that needs these trees for whatever it is we're protecting, if it's not, in fact, the trees themselves, do we have the access to the right space for that to happen? Are we looking for places that are naturally climate refuges, places where climate change isn't expected to be as rapid because of some other physical factor, be it latitudinal gradients, altitudinal gradients, something. Increased heterogeneity of the site, meaning that it's very diverse, it has a lot going on, so there's a lot of variability, which means it will be less impacted, perhaps. So protecting those kinds of areas. In generally also increasing the size of protected areas, but also they can be multi-use. We just need to make sure that things can move through them. The second thing we have to do is reduce the non-climate stresses. We know that the climatological stresses, be it changes in water availability, be it temperature, whatever those stresses are, when you add those to a secondary stressor, you almost always see a more detrimental effect than either one by themselves. So that means things like pollutants. We want to limit those in the environment. We want to limit over-harvest because we don't want to so challenge a population that when you add the threat of climate change to it, it can't recover from it. We want to protect from invasive species because generally invasive species have a wider tolerance to climatological changes, and we don't want them to outcompete the native species that we're interested in protecting in these areas. And we want to limit habitat fragmentation so that, again, things can move through the systems as they need. And then we want to start implementing these strategies now, but do them in a manner that we can monitor them. We want to watch what we're doing to make sure that it's working, and we want to be able to share the lessons that we learn in these areas with places that don't have the resources to do these studies themselves but need to implement the same things. So that's what we're doing in terms of conservation. We actually have projects going on in mangrove systems, in coral reef systems. We're starting some in high elevation regions in the Andes and the Himalayas, and we're starting to work with some specific species recovery plans as well. So the link between adaptation, which is what I've just been talking about, and I've been talking about in terms of conservation as opposed to human infrastructural adaptation, which is things like building seawalls, better water resource management. But actually, I'd like to talk about seawalls for a second when I just step back.
Yeah, please do.
An interesting thing about the sort of the interface of climate adaptation for human communities and for biodiversity is a study that happened sort of by accident, not really designed for climate change, in Vietnam by the International Red Cross Red Crescent. They were trying to think about what to do about loss due to storm damage along coastal regions, because historically there had been large mangrove forests, but they had been lost over the years for harvest because they make good firewood, unfortunately. Mangroves normally protect coastline. Their roots, if anyone's ever seen mangrove roots, have lots of runners that come out from them, and they actually grab sediment as it's coming out of freshwater systems, and they hold coastline together. But as those had been degraded, there had been increased erosion, and coastal communities were being substantially impacted by storm surge during the monsoon season. They originally looked at how much it would cost to build seawalls, how to construct those, and they decided to instead reforest mangroves. And they've had a wildly successful project where they have put back hundreds of thousands of acres of forest, of mangrove forest, and they've actually had a recovery of the associated biodiversity with mangrove forest that can be sustainably harvested from these systems. And communities have been protected from increasing storm surge. In fact, there was some evidence after the tsunami of last year that regions that had intact mangrove forests were better protected from the devastation of the tsunami. So that's sort of the sign of adaptation, is how do we respond to this? But the key thing to keep in mind is that if, in fact, we get to the projections of climate change that are on the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, projections for the end of the century with a tripling of CO2 because we have done nothing to reduce it, and we're talking about 10-degree changes in temperature, but it's Fahrenheit, sorry, 5 to 6 degree changes in temperature, mm-hmm. that means that adaptation efforts aren't going to succeed. We can't do anything to deal with that kind of climate change. We can't do anything if we get more than a meter of sea level rise. That's phenomenal change for communities. We can't keep up with that economically. We can't keep up with that biologically, certainly for biodiversity. So the key thing has to be our actions on mitigation. Adaptation will become too expensive. Mitigation is sort of the pound, the ounce of prevention is a pound of, is more than a pound of cure. So taking action on mitigation is crucial, and mitigation means reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and that means demanding that governments, who are the ones that can regulate this, step up to the plate and set real limits. They set caps on CO2 emissions, they put them into place, and they make them binding, and they work with the other countries of the world to bring them into this approach. It means that we may have to share technologies in order to meet this, but we have to regulate as a bottom line.
We have about 5 more minutes, Lara. I'm wondering if there's a few more things you want to share in conclusion with all this.
Oh, my.
I know. I would say like 7 more minutes, maybe at the most.
It's hard to even know where to begin because it's all such important stuff.
I know.
I mean, the key message I want to get to people is when you hear about all of this, it seems hopeless. It seems as though it's a huge intractable problem. It seems as though individuals are powerless to do anything about it. And the key thing is individuals are not powerless to do something about it. In the United States, where we have a federal government that is not taking action on climate change, local communities and states have moved forward to say, we're going to do something about this. Businesses have moved forward to say, we're going to do something about this. And that may be what drives the United States to finally do something serious. Clean air standards in the United States were largely driven by a single state. The state of California is such a large entity that it could drive federal policy essentially by demanding things from the marketplace. The state of California is stepping up and helping in this. The state of New York, all of the New England governors, as well as the eastern Canadian provinces, provincial leaders, have all signed a pact to move ahead on this. So individuals can be key drivers in this. It's going to your city and saying, I want my city to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol and take action. I want to work on how we can get clean power from our regional power provider, demanding those things from your power provider and saying, we don't want coal. We don't want coal because we don't want it impacting the atmosphere. We don't want coal because we don't want the adverse health and environmental effects locally that coal produces. We want clean, renewable energy, and it means working with companies to come up with ways to make clean, renewable energy safe for the environment. There have been historic concerns about wind power and birds. Most of those have been worked through by Superior siting. But it means demanding those things, not only from your elected officials, but from the companies you do business with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like what you said earlier about land use strategies as well. I think that is important here around this area. People are trying to work on a green belt, which has so many different complications and flaws to it, but I think the idea of protecting wildlife or protecting green spaces for the sake of wildlife itself is quite important.
Absolutely.
Because that,
I mean, the climate change is not the lone issue that we need to deal with,
mm-hmm.
But it is certainly a pressing one that ties into so many other things. And green belts around communities may, in fact, end up being a crucial aspect of adaptation, of providing basically a corridor for species to move through
mm-hmm.
as climate change forces migration.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lara, is there anything else you want to say? We have about 1 or 2 minutes. If not, I'd just like to thank you.
I thank you for having me on, and I certainly don't want people to feel immobilized by this issue. I wanted them to feel motivated, because it's not something that we see the worst effects of today, but for our children and our children's children, this is going to be such a dramatic issue. In the next 10 years, it's going to become more and more dramatic, and we don't want to look back and say, my goodness, we should have done something. Charles Keeling started measuring all of this in the 1950s. The fact that we've done nothing about it thus far should be an embarrassment to us.
Yeah, thank you very much for all the information and the inspiration as well.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. And have a great day, Lara.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.